Well, welcome to the 2007 Coast Lecture. It's great that you're all here. As you know, the tradition of the Coast Lecture is that we ask a member of the faculty to talk about a topic that on the one hand is of general interest or contemporary interest or something of that sort, but at the same time works on a tool, perhaps even a core analytic tool that we associate with law and economics, and especially with the first year curriculum, so that in principle the talk is aimed at the first year class. Though, as you can see from looking around you, the lecture, both this year and other years, is of a sufficient note that it usually attracts people who wish they could pass for first-year students, but sometimes have trouble doing so. But in any event, we're thrilled that you're all here, first-year students, colleagues, guests, and others alike. So our lecturer this year is Professor Anup Malani, who could get a long introduction, but by tradition of the Coast Lecture won't. So I'll only tell you that if part of the idea of a lecture is that the lecturer should be a role model to you, then let Professor Malani be a role model to you. He, unlike most of our faculty, was in fact a law student here. I had the great pleasure of teaching him. Yes, is the answer to your next question. He asked many questions in class, and they were useful and good, and his classmates liked the questions, and his teachers liked the questions. Even more, but well, I'll just delude myself into imagining that his classmates would say, "Shh, Milani's speaking again." What we all imagine when we speak up in class. And then, apart from being a terrific law student with fierce intellectual curiosity, he was also receiving a PhD in economics here across the Midway. And then he went on and punched the tickets that some of us value greatly, clerking for fancy people and writing articles and going to another law school to teach for a while, all, I assume, a build-up to the very highlight of his career of returning here to the classroom and continuing to ask terrific questions, which is really the task that most of us aspire to do for the rest of our lives. So I don't think that this topic needs much of an introduction, except I will say that I first encountered this topic at the restaurant Noodles on 57th Street. That's not an advertisement. I mean, it was an okay meal. Where Professor Malani had an insight that he wanted to try out on me that I think is at the core of this topic. But what I really liked about it was that I saw, I'm not a PowerPointer myself, but what I really liked about it was that there were graphs involved, and I thought we were going to draw the graphs on the table or something. But instead, they were set up for me in three dimensions with the chopsticks, which I thought was really terrific. So I can't wait to see those very same three-dimensional graphs and chopsticks here. And before I give you Professor Malani, let me remind you that it's our tradition to always have questions after talks. And I know that he will welcome your questions, and he will recognize you after the major address is over. So please help me in thanking in advance Professor Anup Malani.
All right. So that was a great introduction. I'm sure the part that you believed the most was the one about me asking questions in class and everybody else listening. I was obviously truthful. But in any case, if you see through that, hopefully you'll still be entertained by the talk. So the first thing I want to do is thank you all for coming today. You know, it's kind of an honor to give the Coast Lecture, and I want to thank Saul for inviting me to do so. You know, me doing the Coast talk or Coast lecture is only half the equation. The other half is actually you sitting through it, so you deserve a lot of credit if you make it through the hour. I also want to thank some colleagues, in addition to Saul that I talked to about this talk before I decided to give it. Some of them are sitting here, Eric Posner, David Weisbach, Doug Lichtman, he might be in the audience, and a few others. I also want to acknowledge, so this paper did start actually with that conversation at Noodles, but developed into a technical working paper on which I have two co-authors. One's also an economist at Northwestern named Abraham Wickelgren, and the other one is an epidemiologist slash economist at Resources for the Future. His name is Ramanan Lakshminarayanan. I should recognize those guys as well. And the last person I want to recognize before I get started and jump in is Eric Wood, who's, I think, a 2L student. When I first started working on this, the technical paper, he provided some important research assistance. Okay, so the first thing I think that I have to do is explain the title of this talk. So a lot of you are probably sitting here wondering, you know, what does this talk have to do with anything academic, let alone law and economics? But some of you, I suspect, follow the news on avian flu. And if you do that, you know what this talk is about a little bit, which is it's about culling chickens in order to prevent the spread of avian flu. So yeah, that's right. That's what this is about. Now, the only concern that I have is that I think that there's a lot of people in this audience who probably saw this lecture or this poster, right, and thought, oh, hey, great, Doc Films is showing some, you know, 1950s horror film about some axe murderer that is bizarrely obsessed with barnyard animals. That would be really cool, but unfortunately, it's not the case. So for those of you that are here for that, I won't be offended if you walk out as long as you do so quietly. Okay, but for the rest of you, we have to return back to the question of what does this have to do with law and economics, right? That's what this lecture is supposed to be about. It's about tools of law and economics. Well, I'm not going to answer that right up front. I'm going to answer that about halfway through the through the lecture, but I want to say one thing, which is that I'm basically going to tell you that the tools that we're going to use, or the techniques that we're going to use, the logical methods that we're going to use to solve the problem of culling chickens, are going to be the same tools that we're going to use to solve a lot of problems in law and economics. So in that sense, I'm going to basically say this is one example of a very general problem that we often face in the law and that we can use economic tools to analyze or address. Okay? So with that, let me begin the substance of my talk. Okay, so the first thing I think you need to be convinced of, perhaps not all of you, but some of you, I think, need to be convinced of, is the idea that avian flu is actually still a serious problem. You probably first recall hearing about avian flu right after Hurricane Katrina, when the newspapers were all obsessed with natural disasters, and what was the next natural disaster around the corner? Avian flu. So lots of stories, oh, impending doom and things like that. Now, that was, 2005 that you heard most of those stories, but nothing really happened, and so a lot of the interest in the press declined. And so you might think, quite normally, hey, maybe avian flu is not as big a deal. I want to actually correct that. I'm not going to say that avian flu is as big as, say, something like AIDS or malaria killing people, but it is a growing problem and growing very, very fast. So this is a slide that depicts, it's a smooth curve of total number of human H5N1 cases. So H5N1 is the strain of flu that's currently spreading and that's called avian flu. This shows the number of cases. That's the blue line. You'll see that it's rising steadily. On the left-hand side is the number of cases. The red line, quite predictably, is the number of deaths from those cases. You'll see that that's also rising over time from 2003 to 2006. So that's concerning. Now, the one promising thing here you might say is, that, oh, look at the death rate. That's the green line. The death rate is simply the number of deaths divided by the number of cases. It's actually declining over time from 2003 to 2005. And the reason for that is that when the first cases came out, nobody knew what the heck this was. And so the people that had it didn't actually get much attention. We didn't know what to do about it. So they died. They had 100% death rate. But this declined as we devoted more and more attention to let's say, WHO devoted more and more attention to avian flu and avian flu cases in humans. So we see the death rate declining. But those gains kind of peaked in 2005. And after 2005, they actually reversed. So 2005, they're 40%. And now they've risen to about 60% death rate. And my deep concern, of which I have only anecdotal evidence of, but no serious concrete evidence, is that one of the reasons that you've seen the increase is because H5N1 has started mutating to become more pathogenic in humans, which would be a disaster. But let's take the best case scenario, that the death rate is 40%. Just to give you some sort of baseline of how important that is, think about the 1918 flu. You might have remembered, those of you who follow the news on avian flu, that this flu is thought to relate very closely genetically to the 1918 flu. So what happened in the 1918 flu? That flu infected roughly one-third of the world's population, so about 500 million people. And it killed about 10% of them, 50 million people. Right? Only 10%. So imagine what could happen now. We have a much larger population, right? Nearly quadruple, and we have a death rate that's four times as high, right? So you can imagine, rough approximation, in a bad outcome, 16 times as many people would die. That would be pretty bad. So that's a reason to be concerned about avian flu. Okay, now I think what we need to remember now, actually, before I go to the next slide, let me tell you a little bit more about avian flu. Avian flu is not called avian flu for no reason. And it's not called avian flu because it's H5N1. I mean, H5N1 is just some specific details about the virus.
and features of a virus and how it's categorized by biologists. The reason avian flu is called avian flu, or H5N1 is called avian flu, is because birds are the primary carriers. So much like, you know, Black Death in the Middle Ages was carried by fleas and perhaps rats, this is carried by birds. Now, even that kind of simplifies things, because avian flu isn't just doesn't go from any bird to humans. What it does is it goes from wild fowl, generally waterborne birds or birds that dwell in water or hang around water and have international migration paths. They're the primary carriers. The reason they're the primary carriers is because they can hold on to the flu, or they can be infected by the flu and not die out very quickly, right? So they can live with the flu. So they become the primary carriers. And what they do is they interact, they land every so often on their migratory paths, they land in backyard farms where there are chickens, and they interact with those chickens. And then those chickens get infected, and they give it to us. Now, how does that happen? It's not like they go and hang out at bars together and kind of catch it this way. It's actually kind of, you know, basic. What ends up happening is that a lot of backyard farms, or farms in general in the third world, will have puddles of water. Fowl will land in the water, defecate in the water, chickens will run through the water or eat food out of the water, right? And they'll catch the flu. In fact, they'll pass it on to humans the exact same way. Not that the humans, the farmers, or their children are eating food out of the water, but they're playing in the water, in the puddles, where the chickens are. And that's the primary way that this is spread to us, right? So we're going from fowl to chickens to us. So it's quite logical, actually, that when people think about, people, I mean governments, think about how can we stop the threat of avian flu to humans, they think, well, we need to stop the link at the chicken, right? If we can kill the chickens, we can stop the flu from spreading to humans. And the logic is pretty simple, right? If you don't like the message, kill the messenger. That's pretty much the message that they're going after here. Yes, we're going to talk about how to kill the messenger efficiently. That's the topic today. Okay, so it's not surprising here we have a list of 30, this is actually an incomplete list of 30 countries that have embarked on major chicken culling programs up through, I think, mid-2006. Okay, so it's in some sense incomplete. 30 countries, big and small, China, Djibouti, all sorts. Okay, but a lot of these are third world governments, and that's actually going to be our focus. The only other thing I guess I should add is that, you know, sometimes you don't get the full impact of what's going on with just a list of countries. About 200 million birds have now been killed. 200 million birds have been killed because of concerns about avian flu. Okay. There are many lessons to draw from this, but one lesson you shouldn't draw from this slide is that it's easy to kill chickens. Okay? It's not easy to kill chickens. And it's not because... Yeah, you're laughing. This is good. It's not because it's hard to actually kill a chicken. Right? You can do the kind of simple approach suggested in the poster. Use an axe. There are actually more efficient approaches. And sadly, humans have a history of being able to kill things. And so we've figured out better ways to kill chickens. So that's not the problem. The problem is that we can't get farmers in the third world to give their governments the chickens so the governments can kill the chickens. And it makes total sense why they won't, right? Remember, farming in the third world, chicken farming in the third world is not like the United States. It's not like Purdue comes along and has this huge facility where they've got 10 million chickens that they're raising to sell in nice packages at the grocery store. No, these are mostly backyard farmers. They're doing many things. Among them, they're raising some chickens in the back to supplement their income. Okay? So it's very hard, and they rely on that income, it's very hard to get them to give the government the chickens, because they need those chickens for income. Okay? So when the government just says, oh, please go to your neighborhood public health office and give us your chickens, they obviously resist. It's not surprising. So that's kind of the central problem that we're going to deal with in this talk. Okay? How does a third world government, developing budget government, get chicken farmers, their backyard chicken farmers, to surrender their chickens to the government so the government can cull them? Okay? That's the fundamental problem. Now, the central answer, okay, the typical approach is going to be that you want to... Oh, by the way, this is just... I stuck this in to give you a sense of the kind of opposition you get, right? These are all farmers complaining about inadequate compensation. And it's supposed to foreshadow the primary approach that governments are going to use to try to get farmers to give them their chickens, and also to tell you, give you a sense of why they oppose it. What is it? The governments are going to try to buy the chickens from the farmers. That's a standard approach.
Now, unfortunately, the reason you get that opposition is because the government doesn't pay enough to the farmers to get them to give them their chickens, right? They're not paying enough to make sure the farmers are indifferent between holding on to the chicken and giving it to the government to kill. Now, why is that? Well, because the farmers can, one reason is going to be because the farmers can sell to the private market, and the government has to compete with the private market. But in order to analyze that, let's start with a kind of more abstract problem. Let's suppose you're a government and you want to buy chickens from a private farmer. What price do you have to offer that farmer? Keeping in mind that, for example, the farmer can sell that chicken to the private market. There are four candidates that I can think of. One is you might offer the price of a sick chicken, right? Because we're dealing with chickens that might be infected with H5N1 with avian flu. Second is the market price. The third is the price of a healthy chicken. And the fourth is actually going to be greater than the price of a healthy chicken. Now, before I tell you analyze these prices, and this is, by the way, the subject of our conversation at Noodles, my conversation with Saul at Noodles, I should tell you one thing. A key central feature of this problem is that you don't know. You, the farmer, you, the government, you, anybody, don't know which chickens are infected and which chickens are not infected. Okay? That makes a lot of sense. H5N1, avian flu, is most dangerous in chickens where you can't tell that the chicken's infected, so you can't stop it, right? It cohabitates with that chicken. The chicken is an infected carrier. It doesn't die out when it has the flu. It's sitting around and it can spread to other people without a problem, right? So you can't tell which chickens have the flu. Okay, so should you, when the government comes in, should it say, hey, farmer, I offer you the price of a sick chicken? No, that's not going to be enough, right? Why? Because the farmer says, hey, look, I can go and I can sell this chicken in the private market. And I know the private market doesn't know, just like the government doesn't know, which chicken is sick and which chicken is healthy. So even if I have a sick chicken in the private market, I'm going to be able to sell it at a higher price than the price of the sick chicken. What price is that? Well, the market is thinking, okay, even if I value sick chickens at zero, I like healthy chickens. And there's a probability, positive probability, that healthy chickens are coming to the market. And I value it. So I'm going to pay a price proportional to the probability that there are healthy chickens in the market times the value of the healthy chicken to me. Okay? That's going to be greater than a sick chicken price. Okay? Because the market price is going to be higher, individual farmer is not going to say, I'll be happy to take the price of sick chicken. So they'll go and try to get the market price. Okay, so you might think, I should stop on one more thing. Price of a sick chicken, sadly, because what I'm going to say, this is the price that most governments are offering their farmers, which is why farmers aren't turning over their chickens. Some rich governments, however, are doing the second option, which is offering the market price of a chicken. That is the chicken price that reflects the expected quality of the chicken. Economists like to call that a lemon's price. Okay, the price that reflects the probability that the product is a lemon, that is to say it's sick. Is that going to be enough? And the answer is no, it's not going to be enough. And the reason is, look, when chicken farmers sell chickens on the market, they're not selling chicken meat, they're selling the live chicken. Okay? The reason is because a live chicken can actually sustain its own meat for a long period of time. When you don't have refrigeration, it's an alternative. Now, chicken farmer can sell the chicken to the market right now, or he can say, well, I'm not getting a really good price now, I'm going to sell next period. That is to say next season. It could be next month, it could be next year. If the government offers a market price, remember this is reflecting the possibility that there could be some sick chickens, the farmer's going to think to himself, well, if I just hold on to my chicken, wait till next month, next season, let the government finish its program of buying all the chickens and culling, everybody's going to think all chickens are healthy. And then I'm going to be able to sell my chicken at the healthy chicken price, which is greater than the market price, right? Because there's no risk that it's a sick chicken. So that's what the farmer's going to do. He's going to try to save the chicken and sell it next season. So a market price is not going to be enough. The government offers that, the chicken farmer is not going to give up the chicken. The third option is to sell it at the healthy chicken price. Now here's the hard part. It's actually not even enough to offer the healthy chicken price. The farmer's not going to give it up, and the reason is because the farmer knows one other thing. Not only is next period or next season everybody going to think that all chickens are healthy, but all the farmers that sold their chickens to the government this period, next period they have to come and repopulate all their chicken farms. They're going to elevate demand for chickens. So next season, the price of chickens is going to be not just a healthy price, but the healthy price plus under additional demand, with excess demand, with chicken farmers trying to repopulate their farms. So it's going to be a scarcity price, or a healthy chicken price under greater demand. In general, that's going to be higher than just the price of a healthy chicken today. So that's the price that the government's going to have to offer in order to get farmers to surrender the chickens. And sadly,
most governments are still on the first two levels, right?
It's to say they're only offering the price of the sick chicken or the market price. So they're way under compensating chicken farmers and thus not getting enough chickens. Okay, so some of you who are economically savvy are going to sit there and say, well, why should I care, right? Why should I care that the government has to pay more? Fine, the government should pay more, but this is just a transfer of money from government coffers to the farmers. No big deal, right? There's no loss. And that's not entirely true, right? Governments just don't have money. They have to get money somehow. And the way they typically get money is through taxation. And taxation can be costly. Now, also the economically savvy among you might say, oh, what about lump sum taxes? Let's save that kind of question for the Q&A period. Let's focus on the typical taxation that you see in the third world. So this is going to be value-added tax or VAT taxation, sales taxes on products. And this is a simple supply-demand curve that kind of tells you, if you don't know, what the cost of a tax is. And this is highly simplistic, okay? Let's suppose the curve labeled S, the supply curve for products, and D is the demand curve for products. The government wants to raise some revenue. How's it going to get some revenue? It's going to charge a tax on the price that people are going to pay. Now, in the absence of tax, price is going to be, and quantity is going to be given by the intersection of the supply and demand curve. Here, that's labeled Q0. Okay? But once you implement the tax, you're going to raise what is called TR on this graph. What you're going to do is you're going to basically, because price has risen, you're actually going to reduce quantity sold. You're going to reduce quantity consumed. Quantity is going to fall from Q0 to QT. And that is going to give you, that's going to be a social cost. Why? Because there's some people that would, without the taxes, consume the good and gotten utility from it, or happiness from it, and now they don't. And the amount that you're losing is, well, the value of that consumption is the area underneath the demand curve. Demand tells you how valuable a product is. But of course, you have to pay for the production of the good. That's given by the supply. The area that's left over, the pink region labeled DL for deadweight loss, that's the social cost of taxation. Okay? So that's the real cost of having to pay the high price. The higher the price you have to pay the farmers, the bigger is the TR rectangle or square, and thus the bigger is the DL, deadweight loss triangle. That's the harm that we're talking about. Okay? So I hope with that I've satisfied some of the economically savvy people. But that's only one of the costs associated with buying chickens at a high price. The second cost is actually something that economists call moral hazard. And what I mean by this is, you know, if you're a farmer and you know that if your chickens get infected with avian flu, no big deal, I'm going to get fully compensated, you're going to take less care to make sure that your chickens don't get infected. What does that mean? Well, remember, chickens get infected when they interact with wild fowl, right, hang around the same puddles. One way to stop that is to make sure that you confine the chickens to their coops, right, the chicken coops, and that you maintain the chicken coops to make sure there are no holes in the wiring and things like that. Now, you have less incentive to do that, confine and maintain the coops, if you know that, well, if they get out and they get avian flu, no big deal, I'm going to get compensated, right? You're not going to take as much care because there's no harm from infection, or there's less harm from infection. So that's the moral hazard. So the problem with full compensation at the level that I suggested is you're going to get a lot more cases of chicken flu, right, avian flu with chickens, than you otherwise would have, and thus you're going to have a higher risk of infection of humans. Okay, so that's the moral hazard. Those are the two costs. Well, so how do we stop that? Right? Is there a policy that we can pursue that would stop that? Now, one approach that could address the moral hazard is obviously, why don't we just regulate farmers and say, hey, backyard farmers, you've got to maintain your chicken coops. Well, you might think, well, if we can't really get them to just walk over to their public health office with the chickens, we probably can't get them to maintain their coops, right? We don't have the resources to do that in the third world. So we have to do another policy. What is that other policy? How about a ban? And not banning chickens. That's hard to do. They already exist. What you do is you ban the sales of chicken or the sale or consumption of chicken meat. Okay? So that's going to be the next possibility. And obviously what happens here is that now if the chicken gets infected, if a farmer's chicken gets infected, they're going to lose the value of that chicken, right? Because we're going to ban the sales of that chicken. So now they have an incentive to take greater care to make sure there's no infection. Okay, is that the right answer? Well, it's unclear, because banning chicken sales or chicken consumption has its own costs. The first one is pretty obvious. It is going to be easier to enforce a ban on consumption of chickens, right? Because there are fewer markets for chickens or restaurants than there are backyard farmers. So the enforcement costs are going to be a little bit lower
maybe feasible, but they're still going to be pretty high. But the first cost is going to be a direct enforcement cost. It's the second cost, I think, that's going to be the most interesting cost. Again, go back to what a chicken farmer can do, right? The chicken farmer is always keeping an eye out for, well, what else could I do with this chicken other than just submit to the government's demand? One possibility is, again, to save the chicken till next season. So let's suppose this season the government bans chicken sales. That means the government that means an individual farmer can't get any money for his or her chicken. But if the farmer simply holds on to the chicken, remember it's a live chicken, for one more year, they can go to the market next year and sell the chicken, right? But then we've got the same infected chicken problem, but it's just next year. So how's the government going to solve that? The government's going to solve that, we're going to have to solve that, by maintaining the ban for as long as there are live chickens out there that carry the flu, right? And if a chicken can carry a flu for the rest of its life, then you've got to ban chickens for as long as all existing living chickens might live. And if you go on to Google, which fortunately none of you have laptops, but if you did, you would find out that the average lifespan of a chicken is 7 to 8 years. That may be how long you'd have to keep the ban in effect. Now you have to remember one thing. Whether you ban or you purchase chickens, this season, nobody's going to be consuming chickens. Okay? So that's not the incremental cost. The incremental cost is that with a ban, you'll have to keep the ban going for a long time. You're going to have to stop consumption for a number of years in addition. So it's the total number of years you're going to have the ban minus one. That's going to be the incremental cost of extended duration. Right? You lose chicken consumption. That's the cost. What's worse, there's a third cost that you might ignore, and that's a distributed impact. If you buy chickens, what are you going to do? You're going to raise taxes, but taxes generally affect a broad swath of society. So you can take from a lot of people to get the resources, to get the revenues to buy the chickens. But if you ban chickens, what you're really doing is you're really going after a small subset of society, backyard farmers, and those typically are people that are poorer in society. So in that sense, if you care about distribution, they're good arguments to do so,
then there's a distributive impact that favors purchasing and disfavors a ban. Okay, so let me actually stop here, summarize, right? So on the one hand, if you purchase, you got to pay a higher price. The cost is the taxation, the efficiency loss from taxation. The second problem is that you've got this moral hazard. Alternatively, you can do a ban. The advantage of a ban is you avoid that moral hazard, right? You efficient, effective infection control, but you have these additional costs, okay? Now, I could stop right there. And you might say, oh, that was interesting. I learned a little bit about calling chickens. That's good. It's useful, but it was no more useful than, let's say, going out to NewYorkTimes.com and finding out what the most emailed story for the day was. And you got about as much valuable information as that, right? So I have to give you a little bit more to make this a worthwhile talk. And in fact, what I need to do is go back to the mission of this talk and relate this problem to law economics. So here's what my main contention is. This problem, the calling chicken problem, getting chickens to surrender their, chicken farmers to surrender their chickens to the government, that problem is like a lot of others in law and economics. What is that problem? The problem is characterized by two basic features. One, the government wants to purchase, not wants to purchase, wants to obtain an asset held by a private party. Now that asset could be something concrete like a chicken, right? Or it could be something abstract, like a right, okay? That's the first feature. The second feature that's important is the individual doesn't necessarily have no value, doesn't necessarily want to just give up that asset. They can sell that asset in the private market and obtain some value for it. And because they can do that, the government has to do something special to get that asset from the individual. And it generally has two options. One, it can buy, right? We talked about that with the chickens. Second, it can ban. It can either buy the asset, or second, it can ban sales of the asset, basically driving the value of the asset down to zero, and so the asset owner is more than willing or indifferent to surrendering that property to the government. Those are the two options. And the general question is, which should the government choose? Should it buy to obtain an asset, or should it ban sales in order to obtain the asset? That's the fundamental problem. I want to give you some examples of this problem. Okay, these are some general ones that I've picked up that are pretty easy. Now, before I begin, there are really immediate examples. This is not the only instance in which the government has wanted to obtain some sort of animal because it carries infectious diseases. This has happened repeatedly in our history, most recently with mad cow, where, for example, England wanted to basically obtain cattle that might be carrying mad cow so that they could cull the cattle.
In the United States, it happened in the first half of the 20th century when the government, everybody thought that cattle carried TB that would spread to humans. So we wanted to combine the cattle so we can cull them. So that's the most immediate one. But there are more interesting examples that are maybe that don't immediately come to mind. So one is endangered species, right? What does the government want? The government wants to stop development on land that might have endangered species. In effect, it wants land with endangered species, right? But the owners of land don't necessarily just want to give up that land, right? They want to develop that land and rent it out, build a resort, get revenue from that resort, right? They want to sell that land in some sense to the private market. The government has two options. You can either ban the land, which is its current approach under the Endangered Species Act. You can't develop on land that has endangered species. That's effectively a ban. Or, alternatively, you could have bought the land and said, we'll buy the land once it has endangered species on it. Guns is another example, right? We think about guns and we think, oh, we're gonna ban guns. Now put aside Second Amendment concerns for a second. We could ban guns. But that's not necessarily the only way to pursue this. The government could say, we're gonna buy guns. We're just gonna take that away from people by compensating them when they give it to us. So that's an alternative. And actually, I think Eric Posner is working on a research project that asks whether a purchase program might be better than a ban. But so guns is another example. Zoning is actually another example, right? So what's the problem with zoning? The government wants, let's say, businesses not to locate next to residential areas, okay? It wants to buy that right of movement away. What are the two ways it can do this? One, it could ban, which is what it currently does, through zoning laws. It bans the business from locating, situating itself next to the residential area. And alternatively, it could buy that right away. How could it do that? For example, it could say, we're going to have development zones, and we will give you tax breaks to locate development zones. You can locate next to the residential area, but we're going to make it cost-effective to locate next to these, not next to the residential areas, next to other businesses. Okay, so that's zoning. And the last one, this might seem a bit of a stretch, but I don't think it is. Remember, the asset doesn't have to be concrete. It could be abstract. It could be intellectual property. So let's suppose there's a company that has a new cloning technology. What the government wants to stop is it wants to obtain cloning. It wants to stop cloning. Right? One way to do this is to just ban cloning. You can't use cloning technology. An alternative approach is going to be, well, we're going to buy the IP rights away from the party that has it, right? The IP rights over the cloning technology. And that would be an alternative.
In each of these cases, again, as I said, there are two options. You can buy or you can ban. And you have to figure out what are the costs of these things. And to evaluate that, there are two basic steps. One is figure out what the implementation costs are. What does it cost to implement a purchase program? Typically, that's going to be the cost of raising revenue, the distortionary effects of taxes. Okay. What are the costs of implementing a ban? That's going to be the enforcement cost of ban. Sometimes it can get interesting, like in the chickens example, right? You have to do a ban for many periods, so that can be kind of interesting. But those implementation costs. And the second basic consideration to look at is moral hazard. What do I mean by moral hazard? I mean strategic behavior. So the government policy listed some sort of strategic behavior that is actually socially unproductive, right? The chickens example, it was you buy and then people take less care prevent an infection from happening in the first place. That's a socially unproductive activity. There could be many others. I'll give you a few examples. So let's do that now. Let's look at implementation costs.
And let's look at the example that I mentioned. It was a zoning, right? One cost of enforcing a zoning law. Remember, zoning law is a ban on businesses. Simply put, businesses locating next to residential areas. One cost of enforcement, very easy to predict. Well, not actually very easy, but it may not be obvious. It's not just the writing of the law and making sure there are cops out there checking it out. One perhaps not obvious one is the lobbying. What do I mean by lobbying? I mean businesses coming in and trying to get city officials to change the zoning laws from the ones that the government initially enacted and intended, or bribing officials to kind of get exemptions from the zoning law. That sort of behavior, right? That sort of politicking behavior actually increases your enforcement cost because it drives down efficiency, or you have to take extra measures to make sure that you're not going to have that kind of lobbying going on. Okay, so that's kind of an implementation cost with zoning. We can give you some interesting examples of moral hazard. Here's a really interesting one. So again, go back to the endangered species example, where the government wants to obtain land that has endangered species. As it turns out, the problem is, and this was pointed out by a guy named Dean Luke, in a Journal of Law and Economics article recently, is that when the government enacted the Endangered Species Act, there was a lag between the date that they passed and the date that it was enacted. During that time, basically owners of land that had endangered species killed the endangered species. Right? So that by the time the law went into effect, there were no endangered species. So my land, I can develop as much as I want to. right? So it caused preemptive habitat destruction. So, and that's a type of moral hazard, right? A ban triggered preemptive habitat destruction that was socially unproductive. That's a form of moral hazard. Strategic behavior that is socially unproductive. We can give you another example, guns example, right? This was a, you know, with the habitat destruction, it was a ban that triggered the bad behavior. Here's an example where a subsidy will trigger bad behavior, much as in the chickens example. So let's suppose the government, instead of banning guns, decided to buy guns. Okay, now you might say, oh, that's ridiculous. The government partially does this now, right? Although you probably don't think very much of it. It's the kind of toy, guns for toys programs where you turn in your gun and get toys. Now that's an inadequate compensation, so we don't think that really gets very much. But imagine if the government did it seriously, we're going to really pay you for the full price of the gun. Or plus some more, maybe. What'll happen? Well, you might suspect, okay, well, then the gun manufacturers just increase the total amount of production, and bam, what we're going to do is end up subsidizing gun manufacturers, right? They're going to increase production, and people are going to take those guns and sell it to the government, right? It's like kind of guaranteed supply. It's kind of a sop to gun manufacturers. We don't necessarily want that. So that's a kind of moral hazard that you might be worried about. But again, in each of these cases, you would look at the implementation costs and compare it. Compare the buy and the ban that way, and then you'd also compare the moral hazard for the buy and the ban, and then decide. Okay, I want to wrap up now, but I want to wrap up with by kind of cleaning up or tying up some loose ends. Okay, so a lot of you might say, that's really great, I'm going to think about implementation costs and moral hazard. Those seem valuable, but you know, about that moral hazard thing, can't we just solve that or get rid of that problem by regulating moral hazard, ban the moral hazard? The answer is not that easy. Okay? Now, for one thing, you want to stop the moral hazard, right? But when you're trying to solve that problem, you face the exact same problem as with everything else. Should you bribe people, buy the moral hazard away? Or should you ban it? Right? It's just the same problem, but now with a different asset that you want. What is that asset? The ability to behave strategically. So that's the first thing to think about. Regulating moral hazard is not trivial. It doesn't get around the problem. It just changes the nature, changes the exact question, but you still have the same buy or ban question or debate. Okay. The second problem is it's not often easy, or often it's not easy to actually ban the moral hazard. And think about it in the chickens example. What are you going to do? You're going to go door to door and make sure the chicken farmers are going to maintain their coops? Well, if you couldn't ban in the first place, that is to say, just take those chickens in the first place, odds are you're not going to get them to do infection control. So it's not going to be easy to do this. It might be easy to do it in France, but probably not in Indonesia, Vietnam, Nigeria, India, places like that where the problem is much more severe. Okay? So regulating moral hazard is not as easy as it sounds. Second loose end, some of you are probably tempted to think, okay, I see that maybe you want to do a ban, sometimes you want to do a buy. Is there any benefit from doing a mixed strategy, kind of doing a combination? So maybe we ban a little bit, it's not completely effective, but it drives down the price a little bit, so it reduces the cost of the purchasing program. Now, in general, the thing that you have to keep in mind is that mixed strategies, this is a term, by the way, invented by game theorists, right? It's mixing the two extremes of buy and ban. In general, it's not going to work unless the relative benefits of a purchase, okay, or the relative benefits of a ban are not rising proportionally with the price that you're paying to purchase, okay, or the probability of enforcement of the ban. Okay? For those of you that are kind of not shy about your technical language, you have to have kind of a proportion or a linear or a monotonic kind of problem. It can't be kind of bizarre in some sense. There can't be some weird discontinuities. But how often does that happen, right? Still, how often can we get a mixed strategy to work? I'm kind of skeptical that you can get a mixed strategy to work many times, that you want to mix these sorts of things. Here's an example. Let's suppose that I'll use species, endangered species as an example. Remember I said you could buy the land or you could ban the land. Suppose, and of course the problem with banning land is you get preemptive habitat destruction. Let's suppose I said, okay, the problem with preemptive habitat destruction is that people kind of know what I'm going to do. Maybe what I should do is I should not decide what I'm going to do, but at the last second, flip a coin. And then, bam, if it turns up heads, I ban. If it's tails, I buy. Okay? And so nobody knows exactly what's going to happen, so they won't do preemptive habitat destruction. But that's not exactly right. It's not that people know that you're not going to ban, or don't know that you're going to ban, so they're not going to take preemptive habitat efforts to preemptively destroy habitat. They're going to say, well, instead of now being certain that starting January 1st or March 1st, the government's going to ban, there's only a 50% chance that's going to happen. So instead of taking 100% effort to destroy the endangered species, the spotted owl or whatnot, I'm going to take half effort, right? All you're going to do is reduce the proportional effect on moral hazard or enforcement costs. You're not going to solve it, right? Unless there's something interesting going on, mixed strategy is not going to help you out. Okay, the last thing, and I think this is what I want to close on, and this is something that you guys will definitely, well, I hope definitely see during your first year, is takings, right? So the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution says basically there will be no takings without just compensation, right? Takings of private property for public use without just compensation. And there are two questions that come up in the legal debates about takings, particularly the law and economics debates on takings. The first is, well, should the government have to offer just compensation? In particular, does it have to offer full reimbursement for the value of private property it's taking? And the second question that comes up is, well, what if instead of the government taking the property, the government just regulates the property? Does it have to then pay compensation? Let me address these each in turn and point out how they relate to what I'm talking about. Let's take the price that it has to pay. Okay, some people in this debate say the government should have to pay full price because it needs to fully internalize the cost of its actions. It needs to know, hey, when it's taking private property, it has to pay a full price. Because if you don't, then the government just willy-nilly take property. I have no argument with those people because I don't even engage in that debate. I'm assuming that the government wants to get the property, and that's fine. I'm going to take that as given that they should be getting the property, not that I want them to think very hard about whether they should. So in that sense, I don't care about the price with respect to the incentive that it gives the government. I think the government's incentives as given, or that is to say, the government's behavior as given. There are other people in this debate that make the opposite argument. Well, the government should not offer very much compensation, because if it offers full compensation, then people, private property owners, won't take complete steps to protect themselves against the takings, or anticipate when taking should be happening to serve a public end. Now, that actual argument overlaps nicely with the arguments that I'm making in this talk, right? This is a situation where if you offer full compensation, people will behave badly, right? They won't fully internalize the reasons for the takings, right? Just think about what happened in the chicken attack. If we offer full compensation, people won't practice infection control. In that sense, it overlaps perfectly. The place where the taking literature stops and this paper begins, or adds something, I should say, this talk adds something, is that you can have the exact same problem, right? You can have the exact same problem with respect to a ban, right? If you don't offer enough competition, you can also trigger moral hazard. And the takings literature doesn't think about that at all, right? Sometimes offering too little reimbursement can also trigger bad strategic behavior by private parties. Okay, now back to the second question. I promise I'll stop right after this. Second question is, should mere regulation cause compensation? And in fact, you know, there's a big debate about this. The government generally doesn't say, you know, regulation causes. That's to say, case law doesn't generally say regulation requires compensation. But there is a Supreme Court case that says if you regulate so much that you basically render property useless, then you might have to offer a compensation. Okay? Is that a good idea? Well, under what I've been saying, maybe not. Right? Like, if you had to every time you ban, in fact, it's complete regulation making something useless. If then you ban, you get offer compensation. That's basically like saying, I'm going to purchase the asset. In effect, that rule rules out the ban option that we've been talking about, leaving you only with a buy option. So to the extent that the buy generates bad moral hazard, you're left without a ban to kind of avoid that moral hazard. You couldn't implement the ban chickens option that I suggested to you.
Okay, with that I'm going to close, and I'll leave one slide up, which is the general point, which is what you should be thinking about in these contexts where the government wants to obtain an asset. Buys or bans should consider implementation costs and moral hazard. Okay, let me open it up for question and answer.
Individual.
So that's great. So the question is,
What exactly is this, for this particular graph, what exactly is intended by the supply curve? What exactly is covered by the demand curve? And, you know, if we tax a lot of people, does it eliminate the dead weight loss? Bullet points, very important. The first one is just for clarification. This is meant to be a simplification. It could be any particular market for a consumption tax, right? In fact, it could also be an income tax, but then the supply would be of labor, okay? So in that sense, I meant to be as general as possible. You pick your market, and this is what a tax would look like. Now, as for the second point, I think that's quite valid. Maybe you want to have a broad-based tax across a whole range of things. That way, to raise any given amount of revenue, you have to change the price for any individual good, just a small amount, not causing deadweight loss. Now, the only problem is that's slightly deceptive, okay? Because what really matters is not the size of the tax increase in one market. What matters is the size of the tax increase in one market times the slope, or proportional to the slope of the demand curve, right? The bigger that slope in some sense, the more elastic is demand, the bigger that loss in that market, even for a small change. Now, the fact that you're going to raise revenue off multiple markets means you've got to add that small change across a whole bunch of markets, okay? Now, if it's highly elastic, you're still going to get a large deadweight loss. Okay, so the fact that you've done it across a lot of markets doesn't necessarily help, unless you think elasticity rises in some sense with the size of the tax break. Now, that I'm not a public finance guy, and I don't know if there's empirical evidence of that, but that's what I would look to be able to answer your question definitively. But knowing nothing else, I'm not sure that actually would raise the deadweight loss. It's a good idea, but I'm not sure.
So if we look to gasoline, for example, which is historically very inelastic, right, consumption of gasoline is going to relatively stay the same, and we spread that across, I don't know, like the entire world, since this could kill people everywhere, it seems like we wouldn't have much of a loss and get the revenue base.
So there, now you've got two other points. So the question is, what if we tax gasoline, and in fact tax gasoline all over the world? The first point is that you're making is that maybe demand for gasoline is inelastic, or there might be some other goods other than gasoline that might be inelastic. In general, that's a good idea. You want to tax things that are inelastic. But even under optimal taxation, there may be still some deadweight loss, right? There might be some inelasticity or elasticity that we can get out of. The second thing is, yes, it's a good idea to actually take it from the whole world in the sense that we're protecting the whole world, but that's a political economy problem, right? Is the United States really ponying up by taxing its taxpayers to help, you know, Burkina Faso do a calling program? Well, sadly, in reality, what happens is often the United States pledges this, or China pledges this sort of money, Japan pledges this sort of money, France does, but doesn't show up at the table with the cash. So in theory, it's nice, but it's very hard to implement this kind of cross-national taxation to the subsidies. Okay. Dave?
You said there was 200 million chickens culled in the last 10 years, 5 years?
Mm-hmm. 200 million culled roughly between... there was a big jump in 1997, and then everything else happens from 2003 to 2006.
I guess wondering what the success rate has been. We know how well it's worked. I mean, you said they're not paying a lot of money. They're not banning them, I think, right? So what's the data?
Well, so let's look at the this is not complete proof, but despite the massive culling programs, we haven't really stopped chicken cases from spreading. Now, this doesn't tell you the number of cases, but this tells you where there are problems. If you looked at the graphs that the WHO has for over time, this would basically show a massive increase over time in the orange territory. So yes, we're culling a lot, but there's a big concern that we're not getting enough of them. We still need to do more. And again, you know, the headlines that I put up just indicate that there's a lot of opposition. There's still a lot of farmers that are not turning over their chickens. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's very similar to the case we're talking about here. For global warming, a lot of those poor countries are willing to sign up for the Kyoto Treaty because it's too costly for them to do so. So some economists have proposed, why don't we use some tradable program, which means like reallocate the quotas to each country. So the rich countries can buy the quota from poor countries. In this way, they can avoid issues like what we just discussed as issue, and also like distributing back these two issues so that they can they can argue to a more efficient outcome. I mean, can we use similar approach to solve the problem here?
So I want to say two things here. So in general, so the question is, can we use some sort of tradable pollution permits to obtain a better result here. And I have two comments on this. First is a very simple and mundane one. Tradable emission permits sounds like a great idea in theory, but it's often very hard to implement in practice, right? Just think about how that would work. I mean, first of all, there's a big political economy considerations. Can we do it with respect to avian flu when people don't know exactly what the risks are and how often you see avian flu? Second is, could you do it within a country, right? So that you're eliminating the distributive effects within a country, which is the kind of distributive effects that I was talking about here. That would be hard to do. The second problem is that I kind of think of tradable emission permits as kind of an implementation point. It doesn't get beyond the fundamental point of do you want to ban or do you want to buy. It just says that once you've decided that, let's do it in the most efficient way possible with some sort of tradable permits to make sure the most efficient people are doing something, whatever it happens to be. In global warming, it's reducing CO2. Here, perhaps, it's doing infection control. The only problem with that, obviously, going back to the implementation point, is that everybody's got to practice infection control. You can't substitute, right? In global warming, if the United States reduces its CO2, it's helping everybody else, right? It's a substitute for them. In this context, it's almost like the lowest common denominator determines the results. Even if India, Egypt, are doing the best that we can, if China's not, if Indonesia's not, we're in trouble. So everybody's got to behave perfectly, in some sense, but really it's limited. And I understand you can reduce risk and stuff, but if it affects disease, you might think the threshold is a little bit more jagged. So that's the only reason I'm not completely optimistic about trade performance in this context.
If you have to pay the farmer the price of the healthy chicken plus expected demand, doesn't that just exacerbate the problem where the farmer then has expectation of more chickens being bought by other farmers, so he wants to hold on to his chickens even more?
Can you explain a little more?
If the government is then having a higher price, it's going to more farmers are willing to turn over their chickens, at which point farmers will then know that there's going to be even smaller of a supply next time, so it just recycles.
Yeah, but actually, I'm going even further than you. I'm saying the government wants to obtain all chickens in a particular region, so it actually wants to buy all of them. So the government's trying to get the price to go to the ultimate extreme. In fact, when I say under elevated demand, right, the price of the healthy chickens are elevated demand, I mean once the government adds to the demand curve the total amount of chickens that are in existence today. In
a particular region. To incentivize some people to hold on to them knowing next season there will be no other supply besides theirs?
No, they're indifferent, right? Because they've been fully compensated for that increased price. Even if they sell the chickens, they have the extra price to be able to buy a chicken next year. So they're indifferent. Yes?
So this is kind of a question on how you need to spread. I'm a little confused here. Why is it that they want to just give the chickens that are alive now? If we have this high cost, won't farmers then like have more chickens, like take more eggs and turn them into chickens? And isn't the problem like perpetuate itself? Because they say, okay, I know for the next 8 years the government's gonna be buying chickens. So right now I'm gonna raise some baby chickens up, and in 4 years I'm gonna sell those to the government, whereas they might just sell those eggs off today to someone at an egg market.
So the question is a good one. So I'm gonna rephrase, hope you don't mind. Isn't there an additional moral hazard that you haven't talked about associated with buying chickens? And that is, if you know in the future that in your region, if there is an infection, the government's going to come in and buy, maybe today what you're going to do, you're going to try to increase the amount of chickens that exist, right? You're going to try to raise more chickens, get your chickens to procreate. And the answer is yes, right? That's a very good point. Just like in the guns example, if the government decided to buy guns, gun manufacturers would increase gun production, In that same way, farmers, knowing that down the road the government might be buying chickens and paying a good amount for it, might increase the amount of chickens they produce. And that would, in fact, also be a loss because there's excess chicken production. That's wasteful activity as well. Now, the question is that as big a magnitude problem as the infection control problem? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. I hadn't thought about it, but that's plausible, too. So that's good. That's another source of moral hazard. Yes?
You say that doing both generally is bad.
It's not clear that doing both is going to get you anything more than doing these things.
Right.
So I don't say it's bad.
Okay.
I'm just saying that it's not clear that it's a gain.
But is possibly doing one and then the other possibly going to get you better gains? Like in the gun or in the endangered species example, had the government decided to buy land currently that endangered species and then at some future point, if you got the ban.
Yeah. Well, so what does that do? Unless you think that somehow people are seeing into the future, all they're doing is they're saying, okay, I get price now plus a probability of ban. It's just a mixed strategy. If you do it directly right now, then you're not going to gain anything, as long as there's anticipation effects. Now, if you think that somehow there's something weird. People have cognitive disabilities or shortcomings that prevent them from seeing the future. Well, then the ban is not going to do much in terms of incentives. So you need actually some sort of cognitive disability, some story about a cognitive disability that's going to create some kind of kink, some kind of nonlinearity, something weird that makes it so that the mix, the average, is going to somehow be better than the extremes. But to me, that's not entirely it's not clear what kind of behavior generates that.
Banning, like, if you were going to buy all the guns now, you'd want to ban future production of guns?
Oh, that's a different question, right? So now the question is, what if we buy the guns, but we also ban the production of additional guns? Okay? That's like banning moral hazard, right? That was the three loose ends. It was the first loose end. Now, of course, then you just have to ask yourself, do I want... Remember, it's just changing the focus of our attention. Before, we're worried about the guns in the hands of private individuals. Now we're worried about gun production. We want to take away gun production. We just face the same question. Do we want to ban the gun production, or do we want to buy gun, bribe gun manufacturers not to produce guns? Okay? Back there, yeah, last word.
So this is a suggestion for something other than buy versus ban, which is like an in-kind exchange. So the government says, if you turn in a chicken, we'll give you a goat.
Yeah.
Right? So that might have two really positive things. One, you create a new market that doesn't have the same lemon problem, because goats can't be infected.
Okay.
And then you've also made a substitute for chicken much cheaper, which is going to, right, if you subsidize the goat, you figure one goat is worth more than one chicken. We get a substitute for chicken somewhat cheaper, which reduces some of the more hazardous behavior of the chicken problem.
Okay, so let me put aside just for a second. So the question is, what if we had an in-kind exchange where instead of giving people chicken money for chickens, we gave them a goat for a chicken? Each chicken comes with a goat, or maybe each two chickens come with a goat. Okay, the first problem with that is that you've got to figure out what the prices are, again, with the goats, right? It's not going to be free. You've got to buy the goat. And what's the farmer going to say? Well, I'm only going to take a goat if the dollar value, or you know, if you're maybe a rupiah value or something like that, right, is equal to the value of the number of chickens that I'm taking away. So in that sense, it's not saving the government any money, right? Because you still have to, for the farmer to be convinced to surrender the chicken, you have to give us a fair transaction. Now, the second question is, well, is it better to take the chickens away, kill them, right? Or is it better to swap the chickens for the goats? Will that somehow decrease the risk? Now, ultimately, that's an epidemiological issue, and partly a kind of what is the nature of demand for food issue in that country. If by introducing goats instead of chickens, if people are just going to switch to goats, and goats are actually less susceptible to avian flu, you're well off, right? That's actually an improvement. But we don't know if people are actually going to necessarily switch, okay? And we also, by the way, don't know if goats can't be infected. Could be that they can be infected, just there's not as many of them being infected. The second thing is that ultimately, either way, you're getting rid of the current crop of sick chickens. Right? That's the key thing. And you should separately address the question of, do we want to, going forward, even if our population was a population of chickens was completely healthy, do we want to get rid of chickens and switch to goats? Right? So in that sense, your solution, which is a great one, should be directed at not the sick chicken population, just do we want to get out of chickens altogether? And we can even go further. Maybe we want to get out of, if we can, drive people to stop doing backyard farming and switch to corporate farming, because that's less likely, or because it's easier to control infection in corporate farming than it is in backyard farming. Right? But those are things that I think are great ideas. They're just not the problem that you face once you have the infection. It's a problem that you can start thinking about now, even before an infection. Yes?
You talked about the shooting the messenger.
Yeah.
What about free development?
Yeah, so, you know, I've actually ignored a lot of other solutions, right? Remember I said there's fowl, the chickens, to humans. There's a whole bunch of people that are focusing on the humans, right? Vaccines, antiviral prophylaxis, things like that, good quarantines, things like that. At the same time, there are people that are trying to focus on the fowl. One solution might be, one that's not proposed so much, is that it's not for a therapy to kill wild fowl. Now, the problem with that is, first, they're big enforcement problems. It's not easy just to catch fowl. Second, it's a multinational problem that leads to a collective action problem. Let's suppose that you've got a fowl traveling from eastern Russia down from India to southern Africa, right? Who's going to have the incentive to do all the killing? If India invests a lot in the killing, it's really going to benefit the people in South Africa. If South Africa does the killing, it's going to benefit India and Russia. So in that sense, it's getting the fowl out of the system has been a little hard. And that's also, again, ignoring, you know, maybe you know, it's one thing, we might think we can take the chickens out of the system because it's domesticated without really endangering the food web. We don't know what's going to happen if we kill fowl, right? We don't know what the secondary impact is going to be. And that could be really bad. So I think that's one of the reasons we haven't really focused on killing the other messengers, right?
Is anyone focusing on diagnosing chickens to see if they're infected or not?
Yeah, no, there's a lot of effort. I mean, not as much as for humans, but a lot of effort to try to develop better diagnostic technology to figure out if chickens are infected. Now, the problem with that is not so much just getting the technology. It's implementing this technology, right? So you have to disperse it among the backyard farmers and get them to actually do the testing and then report the results. And that itself is a separate problem, which I'm happy to talk about. But that's a big thicket that's, I actually think, is much more complicated than this problem. Not that, that it wouldn't be a good idea, but when we are pursuing it, it's not clear that that's always in the work. Over there, up in the corner.
What is the more efficient way of killing
What is the more efficient way? I'll tell you the answer. At least I'll tell you the answer that I think is correct. And it may not be entirely satisfying to you. If it's the case that chickens do not live a long time with the flu, even if they can survive the flu a little bit, or they don't carry the flu for a long time, the flu leaves them. By the way, these are open medical questions, right? So that is to say, if a chicken gets the flu, the chicken dies this year, this season, or the flu leaves the body this year, I think I'd favor a ban, okay? I think I'd favor a ban because of that moral hazard in terms of infection control. But if it's going to be a longer period of time, I tend to go back in favor of wanting to buy. And I actually like that some of you suggested, you know, we should have cross-national subsidies. I think that's right. So I would like to see some more cross-national subsidies to buy. You see effort that, in that direction by the World Bank, but, you know, I have to say, it's not effective. People don't always pony up the cash once they promise.
You're taking my question so much more seriously.
I have that problem.
Failing in access. What do they do?
There was that picture, the lethal injection, but that's often kind of hard. You can burn, sadly, using gas, but those are typically the ways. I mean, it just reminds me of some of the worst things we do in other contexts, but that's how we do it. It's not a pleasant process.
I've got one more,
okay. Already, yeah.
Seems like great lecture. You made a bunch of points on the supply side of the case. What about this maybe a moral hazard on my part? What about letting a free market deal with it? If governments acknowledge that there is chicken disease, the avian flu, well, wouldn't it incentivize consumers not to purchase chickens? As a result, sort of put the onus upon the backyard farmers to take the proper steps, take the necessary steps to protect their flocks so that they don't lose that market. Instead of that way, I sort of like get rid of the tax problem, get rid of the trying to cheat the system problem. It's just the onus is now on the backyard farmers to make sure their flocks are protected so they can still have that willingness to sell them.
Okay, so here's the problem with this. Let's suppose, so the question is, can't the private market solve this? If a farmer lets his or her chickens get infected, then they're going to have to sell that chicken at a smaller price, at a lower price, right, reflecting the sickness. Here's the key problem. People don't know which chickens are infected. So let's suppose that you're one farmer, I'm another farmer, and I decide, well, look, take less effort to protect against the infection, get my chickens infected, what's going to happen? Are people only going to pay me a sick chicken price? No. They're going to know that you have got some healthy chickens that you're selling on the market, so they're going to actually offer a slight high healthy chicken price to me as well, because they can't differentiate our chickens, and they don't know which one of us is actually taking greater care. So in that sense, as long as you're doing some effort and I'm not, I get to benefit from it. So there's that kind of externality that's going on, or collective action problem that's going on. I get to externalize the cost of my bad behavior, which is lack of infection control, on you, and your whatever good behavior you're engaging, you're actually externalizing that on me because nobody knows. They can't differentiate us. So in that sense, the private market doesn't work as well. In fact, a guy actually won the Nobel Prize talking about lemon equilibrium to make this exact same point. A guy named George Applewhite. But that was the fundamental issue. Private markets often won't work.
So please join Professor Milani and everyone here for a reception outside, and that's for the talk. That was terrific. Thank you.